This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with our own Michael Ratner, attorney for WikiLeaks, on the two-year anniversary of Julian taking refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy.
Julian's been granted asylum, and despite his confinement at the embassy, has been active as the publisher and editor of WikiLeaks.
We'll examine a recent California court decision striking down a series of laws that grant tenure and other protections to public school teachers.
For a number of years now, there's been an onslaught in this country to privatize public education. This is one of their latest moves.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael Ratner, at the time that we're taping this show, it looks as though the U.S. might be considering drone attacks on Iraq.
You know, it's hard to believe this country sometimes. I mean, it's impossible. I mean, Michael and I are the same age. You're a little younger, Heidi. Well, I know, a lot younger, maybe. What are you, 30 now? But in any case, not to make fun of this, but Michael and I have been basically fighting against war since we were kids. I mean, World War II is one thing. Of course, they could have done something by not arming the Germans. But then we had the Korean War. Then we had Vietnam. And we had all kinds of other stuff. Then we had the Central American Wars. Then we had the Iraq War, first number one. Then we had number two Iraq War. And of course, that's the one that you could argue brought us to where we are now, where we had a war that was utterly supported by the press, the Times, the media, you know, all these people, from people like Anne Marie Slaughter, who supported it, now regrets it, George Packer, quote, New Yorker liberal, now regrets it, all these people who our friend Tony Jute, the writer from the UK, called Bush's useful idiots. So you have all of these Bush's useful idiots who supported the overthrow of Saddam Hussein, which was about the only stability Iraq has probably seen in 100 years, and now they basically, the biblical expression is sow the wind and reap the whirlwind. So now we're reaping the whirlwind. And one of the things that we talk about here is, how do these people who gave us the illegal war in Iraq and supported it, including Tom Friedman, our wonderful guy at the New York Times, all of these people, Bush's useful idiots, how are they put in newspapers, how are they put on TV to tell us again that we have to go to war with Iraq? Or with Syria, or name your country in the Middle East. I mean, these people should be drummed out of the country. They should be drummed off the pages of the New York Times, drummed off the TV. I don't know. We can talk about some specifics, but there's one today that really threw me completely. There I see, I open the New Times, and I see a huge op-ed.
The New York Times, yeah, your favorite paper.
By Anne Marie Slaughter, saying...
Aptly named.
Right, yes. Now, I think she's at some foundation, but she was head of actually the... ASOL, American Society of International Law, professor at Princeton, et cetera, et cetera.
She's a lawyer.
She's basically, she's basically a Samantha Power who's not in government, which is to say a humanitarian interventionist. Use military whenever you can to save human beings. When in fact, if you look at every time they've done it, it basically kills more people and leads to where we are in Iraq. So there's Anne Marie Slaughter writing this big op-ed about, we have to intervene in Syria, stop the jihadists in Syria, that's what's leading into Iraq and all this. This is the same person who, as I said, supported the war in Iraq initially, now regrets it, and bragged to me once on a Twitter that she had supported really what happened in Libya because look what it did for women or something like that. I mean, I don't recall it exactly. But as I recall, she supported the war in Libya. And look what we got in Libya. We got complete, utter chaos in Libya. So the U.S. can't do anything in Libya. And there was an interview the other day, a long New York Times article. It was about some general who's going to be in charge of counterinsurgency in Africa.
Right.
And he basically said, well, what happened is there's no stability in Libya, so we can't do much in Libya. And what happened is the people then went in and conquered, after we overthrew them, they went and conquered northern Mali. So now the jihadists are in northern Mali. We've covered that on this program. But so there you got from Libya, supported by really every one of these liberal humanitarian interventionists, from Samantha Power to Anne Marie Slaughter to all these other characters out there. They got us Libya. They then got us Iraq, and they got us Afghanistan. So we're talking about a situation here in which, as Michael Smith often says, there's one party but two wings. What is it you said? We only have one party in this country. And you see it with all these people wanting to intervene. But that they keep dragging these people back out to tell us that we have to go to war again, I find to be absolutely amazing. I mean, we've completely destroyed the stability, whatever stability there was in the Middle East, completely destroyed it. And then, of course, when they overthrew Morsi in Egypt, the U.S. didn't do a thing. Here's a coup happening, and they now are basically hand in glove with a dictatorship in Egypt that's a killer dictatorship, a so-called election. Of course, that was not really that, and in which a democratically elected government was overthrown. So I don't know what else to say except drum these people off the papers. This is why we need programs like Law and Disorder and all the other alternative media we have out there. Anything else?
Hear, hear.
I just want to recall a story that happened years ago, but it gives you an idea of what the United States is able to do and rationalizes doing and why we're so hated around the globe. 60 Minutes had an interview by Leslie Stahl with then Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. And this is back in the 90s after the sanctions that the United States brought against Iraq to try to destabilize it. Leslie Stahl asked Madeleine Albright, she said, "Madam Secretary, I understand that as a consequence of the American sanctions against Iraq, some 600,000 children have died. Do you think that this is justified?" And Albright thought about it for a moment, and she said, "Yes, I do." That was the beginning of what they've done to Iraq. We then saw shock and awe, the destruction of Fallujah, the driving out of Saddam and the Sunnis, who had been the ruling elements in Iraq for many decades, and the beginnings of sectarian warfare, and the utter destruction of the infrastructure of that country, so that people are refugees, they're homeless, they're unemployed, they're absolutely desperate. Into that situation, you know, you now have Americans talking about how they want to bomb Iraq. What good could come from bombing those people yet again? And that's the kind of discussion we're having. And they're trotting out these people from years ago after 9/11 when they said that Saddam, they lied, and they said Saddam had weapons of mass destruction, and they said Saddam was in league with al-Qaeda. Lies. And based on those lies, they committed the supreme crime, a war of aggression. They dismantled Iraq. And now what do they want to do in the turmoil that's happening there? They want to bomb them again. This is the moral level that the leadership of this country and both parties represent.
Just remember, as Hillary Clinton tries to become president of the United States, just remember her vote on Iraq. She voted in favor of the Iraq war. She did it, whether she believed it or not, I doubt she believed it, that there were weapons of mass destruction there or chemical weapons or anything else. She did it because she thought she could become president back then by showing herself as a warmonger. In fact, she probably is a warmonger. She's certainly one of Bush's useful idiots, and that should never, never, never be forgotten. And just remember, what did Martin Luther King say about the United States back in mid-60s? He said, "The United States is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world." What remains true today? The United States is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world. Michael, so I understand we finally won the trifecta.
Well, yes. Heidi and you before her made presentations about your books at the New York Public Library. And this is an invitation for all you listeners out there, because on Monday, June 23rd at 6:30 at the Mid-Manhattan Library on 5th Avenue and 40th Street, that's 455 5th Avenue, southeast corner of 5th Avenue and 40th Street, I'm going to be speaking about the book I co-edited, Living in a Socialist USA. Imagine Living in a Socialist USA. And I'm going to be speaking with my two co-editors, Debbie Smith, Francis Golden, Cliff Connor, who wrote the chapter on how to get from where we are to where we want to be, and Fred Jerome, who wrote the chapter on media. So we ask all of you to consider coming down on Monday, June 23rd, the Mid-Manhattan Library. It's on the southeast corner of 40th and 5th Avenue, not the one with the lions, the one kitty corner from the lions. It's up on the 6th floor. We got a big room, a microphone, and a stage, and the New York Public Library has given us a platform to talk about, imagine, living in a socialist USA. They put out a leaflet. Listen to this, Michael. They put out a leaflet that says, pulling the curtain back on the true meaning of socialism.
I'm amazed, actually. I mean, this is the major institution, or one of the major institutions in New York City. It is a public institution, which is the public library, but it's remarkable they're doing this book. So it's great, Michael. I think everybody who listens to this should get there. It's an amazing forum. Congratulations.
Thanks. The book is divided into three sections. The easiest section to write was an indictment of capitalism. All you have to do is really listen to this radio show or WBAI every day. The major part of the book is how every institution in this country would be different if we got rid of the capitalist system, if we got rid of making commodities for profit. And then the third part of the book is how to get from where we are to where we want to be. That's what we're going to be talking about on June 23rd. Mid-Manhattan Public Library, 40th and 5th Avenue, 636th floor. Be there. Michael Ratner, last week was the second anniversary of Julian Assange being stuck in the embassy, Ecuadorian embassy in London. Can you tell us an update on that?
Yes, he's been there now 2 years. It was June 19th. 2 years ago, when Julian walked into the embassy, he asked for political asylum, which a few weeks later, the Ecuadorians, who must be heavily thanked, gave him political asylum. So he's sitting in the embassy with political asylum. I have visited him there many times. Don't get any idea in your head that it's some big, fancy, luxurious embassy. It's an apartment on a ground floor with about 6 or 8 rooms. He has one of those rooms. It's small. There's no outside space. He has to have a sun lamp because there's not really any sun he can get, a little bit through the windows, but it's not enough. It's a custody. He's in custody, and not of the Ecuadorians, but he's essentially can't leave those rooms, and he's in a particular place. He's not allowed to walk out on the street. There's permanent...
Michael, are there police, like, outside waiting?
Yes, there's police. You go up there. There's police right in front. There's a policeman inside on the first floor when you walk in. They're at every window. There's a big couple of police vans outside with antenna picking up every one of your conversations. That's where Julian has been for 2 years.
Michael, tell me, and refresh our audience, what did Julian do to deserve this, and what can we do to get him out of it?
Well, let me back up for a second. I think one thing that's important for everybody to know is that Julian's in pretty good shape in there. I mean, he's been functioning. WikiLeaks has been functioning. It's done remarkable work while he's been in there. The first thing, and I think a key thing that people have to understand, is they basically, WikiLeaks, Sarah Harrison, Julian, and others, saved Edward Snowden from going to prison in the United States. Remember, he was in Hong Kong. The U.S. issued a criminal complaint against him. 2 counts of espionage. One count of theft of documents. This is against Edward Snowden. There was an extradition request by the U.S., Hong Kong being part of China. The likelihood is that 90%, 95%, or 100% that Edward Snowden would have wound up in a U.S. jail. Instead of that, WikiLeaks helped him gain asylum, where he eventually did in Russia. Sarah Harrison accompanied him on the plane to Moscow, filed applications for asylum for him, and eventually he got it. So they played a heroic role for Edward Snowden. It's one that has been recognized by many people. Glenn Greenwald in particular has said in his book, in acknowledgments in the back of the book, saying, but for the work of WikiLeaks, Sarah Harrison, we would not have Edward Snowden participating in the debates right now about what the National Security Agency has done. So while Julian Assange is in the embassy, cannot leave, he is doing effective work. Think of another story we've covered on here, Heidi and Michael Smith. We've covered the Trans-Pacific Partnership. That's the so-called trade agreement the U.S. is trying to impose on countries, particularly in the Far East. That's very unfair to a number of those countries, as well as to, of course, populations encompassed in those countries. They've exposed the negotiating terms of some of those agreements, and that's been very, very critical. So they've done a huge amount of work while Julian is in there.
Michael, what kind of pressure, if any, is the U.S. government putting on the embassy, and how long can Julian remain there, do you think?
It's an important question. I think the U.S. is the bear in the room here. We could deal with, and I'll go over each country, we could deal with Sweden, we could deal with the U.K., we could deal. Obviously, Ecuador has been favorable. It's the U.S. where we have a real issue. The U.S., since I've started working on the case and before, for 4 years now, has had a criminal investigation going against Julian Assange and WikiLeaks. They've had a grand jury. It's a huge investigation, serious investigation. The Chelsea Manning trial, it came out that there was files of, you know, perhaps 50,000 or more files and documents. That was back then, a couple of years ago. There's many more than that. There's 20 agencies that have been investigating him. And if there's any doubt in anyone's mind whether this investigation is continuing, despite claims by Holder, oh, we're not going to prosecute journalists, what the U.S. just admitted in April of 2014, a few months ago, they filed a brief in federal court. It was a brief in which they were trying to refuse to give up documents in a Freedom of Information Act case. And their claim was they couldn't give them up because there's a continuing investigation going. It was documents that we sought around WikiLeaks, or that actually Epic sought, the group we interviewed last week on our show. And they came up with what's called the continuing investigation excuse. And in that brief, filed in federal court, they said, the Department of Justice said, there's an ongoing criminal national security investigation into WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. It's multi-subject and it's ongoing. And it's huge. So that investigation is still continuing. When I say it's the bear in the room, Julian Assange, let's say he somehow was able, or Sweden, in any case, was able, and we'll get to that in a second, able to deal with what the sexual misconduct allegations in Sweden and deal with some other issues. If he walked out of that embassy, he might very well likely be hit with extradition to the United States, whether that would be from the UK or Sweden if he ultimately got there. And of course, that and the conditions he would face would be awful. If we look at what happened to Chelsea Manning, from torture to 35 years in prison, to our special units of prisons that don't allow any talking outside, et cetera, very harsh conditions. That's, in fact, one of the reasons that Ecuador gave Julian Assange asylum, first because he was persecuted as a whistleblower, and secondly, and perhaps as equally important, is that he would not receive a fair trial, and the conditions in the United States were awful. So that's the United States. Now let's look at a couple of other things that have happened. As I said, Ecuador has given him asylum. Once you've been given asylum, the conventions and the laws basically say that another country cannot interfere with the right of asylum. So here's Julian Assange sitting in Ecuadorian embassy in London, having been given asylum, and yet the British, the UK, refuses to give him a free passage to Ecuador out of that embassy. That's considered
obstruction.
Obstruction of his right to asylum. Likewise, if Julian went to Sweden, Sweden has refused to guarantee that they would honor his right to asylum and send him to Ecuador rather than send him to the United States.
So, also obstruction.
Also obstruction. So that you see that Sweden and the UK are both interfering with the Ecuadorian grant to Julian of political asylum.
And can I ask, what recourse is there to confront those countries legally?
Well, they're certainly being confronted diplomatically, and the question is whether and when Julian Assange decides to go into some kind of international court to try and guarantee the right of asylum. Of course, once you go into court, you know, one problem is, of course, then the country say, well, it's in court, we're not going to say, and that could take many years. So, and you don't know the result, of course, although I do think he has a very strong claim that both Sweden and the UK are interfering with his right of asylum and that right to go to Ecuador. Now, let's look at Sweden for a second. There's a couple of things that have to be explained about Sweden. It's been 4 years, really, since the allegations of sexual misconduct have been made against Julian Assange by two women, but particularly by the prosecutor, who seems to have vengeance to carry this out. Now, just remember, they're allegations. They're not charges. They asked to extradite Julian Assange based on those allegations. The British courts upheld that extradition based on merely allegations.
Is that unusual?
It's unusual in this sense in particular. Britain was one of the only countries that allowed that. And secondly, Britain, because of the Assange case, actually has changed the law now. Allegations from a prosecutor from another country are not sufficient to get someone extradited. But of course, the British in their great wisdom said it's not retroactive. So now you have a situation where if Julian Assange had to face extradition today for the allegations in Sweden, if he had to face that today, he would not be extradited. There would be no order for extradition. So the law has been changed. You now need, in the UK, a decision to prosecute, a decision to charge, rather,
Which is sort of like an indictment in our country.
Right, or and a decision that you're going to do it.
Right.
Right. And they haven't done that. And 4 years later, they still haven't done it. And if we add to that with regard to Sweden, for these 2 years he's been in the embassy, he has said he is willing to answer the questions that Sweden wants to ask him. That is why they wanted him in Sweden, to ask questions of him. That's what the extradition warrant was about. He's asked four times. I'll do it by video. I'll do it by phone. I'll do it in person if you want to come and visit me at the embassy. I'll do it any way you want, in written questions. And so far, the prosecutor over these 2 years has refused to come to the embassy in any of those forms and ask any questions of Julian Assange. So when you ask who's delaying this case, who's holding it up, you have to say that somehow Sweden is just unwilling to ask questions. Perhaps they like Julian Assange in limbo.
Of course, it sounds like that. But my question is, isn't there some kind of statute of limitations about how many years they can be in this limbo without charging or doing anything else?
Assuming the statutes of limitations run in this case, which I think they do, that some of the charges or allegations, there are no charges, some of the allegations will be stale or out of date within 5 years. So within another year, some of those allegations will start dropping off. Not all of them may have longer than a 5 year window. Now, the other thing about Sweden that's important is just last week, because of what's happened in Sweden with two issues. One, they have the worst reputation in the European Union for pretrial detention. They just stick people in prison all the time, not just wanting to do Julian had he gone there, but all the time. And they have a terribly arbitrary system of prosecutors that are not controlled by the judges or by the judicial system. And so what's happened in this case, where do you go when a prosecutor doesn't do what she is supposed to do, which is go to the embassy and ask questions of Julian, as they've done many times in other cases in Sweden, in other countries. So what happened last week is really significant, is Sweden's human rights record is reviewed every 4 years, like all countries, for their compliance with human rights, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the International Covenant on Economic and Social Justice, what we call the International Bill of Rights, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Sweden is up for review in September. By June 15th of this year, people who were involved in human rights are permitted to put in briefs, etc., to the UN as to whether Sweden has complied or not with its human rights record. Now, when I say on June 15th, not one, not two, but 59 different civic and human rights organizations put in briefs saying that Sweden has failed to comply with its human rights obligations. It's called the Universal Periodic Review.
Right.
So 59 countries are now complaining, not countries, but human rights organizations and others, the arbitrary denial of rights to Julian Assange and in general that take place in Sweden. So Sweden
That's impressive.
Right. Sweden is out of compliance with its human rights obligations. It's failed to really follow up on allegations, and it's sat there. And I think things are beginning to break open in Sweden about this, because, in fact, Sweden looks terrible.
Right.
Sweden, this country that everybody supposedly thinks is so great, it turns out it's not. But in this respect, certainly, we have seen firsthand that it's not. So we have Sweden being involved in that. We have the UK having changed the law so he could no longer be extradited, refusing to recognize his right to asylum. And then the US, the big bear in the room. My hopes for this case.
But Michael, before you go to your hopes, what about Ecuador? I'm still just concerned. Might they say after another year or so, we're sick of this arrangement, Julian, you have to go?
Ecuador has been extremely supportive of Julian. There was recently, they do these, I think they're called encuentros or something like that, where President Correa talks about various issues. And I think recently there was done about their obligations to Julian Assange. I think that Ecuador has really stood up in a way that, you know, that is just very remarkable and amazing. And, of course, Correa will be president for at least, I think, another 3 years now. Hopefully this case will be resolved in a year. I want to close the segment on another important initiative. There's a letter that will be sent within the next few days to our Attorney General, Eric Holder, by at least 30 or so human rights groups from around the world. from Anthony Romero at the ACLU to Article 19 from the UK to others. And that letter basically wants to hold Holder to his words that journalists and editors will
not
be prosecuted.
Won't be subject to prosecution.
And it starts off with a demand to close all criminal investigations of WikiLeaks and its editor-in-chief, Julian Assange. It says that they have to stop harassing and persecuting Julian and WikiLeaks for publishing that is done in the public interest. They go back to Holder's promise that no reporter would go to jail for doing his job. Yet, of course, it appears that they want to send Julian Assange to jail for doing that. It ends with the words, the investigation must come to a close of Julian Assange and WikiLeaks.
Michael, just so we can see the forest from the trees, Julian Assange is a publisher. And my question in a nutshell is, what did he publish that exposed the United States with respect to Iraq and Afghanistan?
You know, it's remarkable. WikiLeaks has existed since certainly 2008, maybe before. There were documents that came out in Chelsea Manning about wanting to destroy WikiLeaks even before the most serious documents came out. But in a nutshell, he started off with Chelsea Manning's collateral murder video, which shows the incredible bloodlust of Americans in a helicopter, gunship, killing two Reuters journalists. Then when the bodies are going to be picked up, shooting at the van that's going to pick them up, injuring two children, killing others. I mean, it's an incredibly blood-chilling video. That video, then they came up with what are called the Iraq war logs. The Iraq war logs just demonstrate blood-killing all over Iraq, 15,000 more civilians killed than the U.S. was willing to say, including the running of torture camps that the U.S. was fully knowledgeable about by the Iraqis, that people were tortured routinely in the mid-2000s, 2003, 2004, thousands of people tortured. That's Iraq. Then we have the Afghan war logs, similar to the numbers of killings that went on in Iraq, the targeting of people, the targeting of civilians, the bloodlust of that war. And then it ended with what really, I think, if you were to say one set of documents really said to the United States government, we're going to put this guy out of business. It's what we call the diplomatic cables or Cablegate, 250,000 low-level, relatively secret cables that expose the criminality, hypocrisy of the United States in dealing with countries all over the world. What came out of that, for example, a secret war in Yemen. What came out was the utter corruption of the Ben Ali government in Tunisia, which was one of the elements that led to the Arab Spring when the Tunisian government was overthrown. I could go on and on.
They were all an embarrassment to the U.S. government.
They were embarrassment, but they also demonstrated—
And illegal actions.
Right, criminality. They showed us that this government is utterly corrupted, utterly criminal, that its wars, as we now see every day, whether in Iraq or Afghanistan, and as Chelsea Manning herself testified, were just fought in a way that was just going to make people hate the United States. And they already did. We were invaders and occupiers. And that's what these documents showed.
Michael, if this has moved our listeners to want to take some action, where do they go?
There's a new website called FreeAssangeNow.org, FreeAssangeNow.org. Go to that website, find out about the case. There's a donate button, and I'll just end this segment by reading you the quote that's on the front page of that website. Quote, "Someone who courageously carries out actions in defense of democratic rights deserves applause, not hysterical denunciation and punishment." Noam Chomsky on Assange.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Welsh, a Silicon Valley tech millionaire, funded the lawsuit out in California called Vergara. Several weeks ago, the Vergara decision came down, and the court struck down a series of laws that granted tenure and other protections to public school teachers. Students Matter, an education reform group, had sued on behalf of 9 students, arguing protections for substandard teachers have a disproportionate impact on children of color and low-income families. The decision, which in part based itself on Brown versus the Board of Education against segregated schools, identified teacher tenure as the cause of underachievement within inner-city schools. The decision could have a large influence in other states. Many see this decision as part of a strategy to transform the public education system into a major profit center. Today we look at bigger context of the Vergara versus California decision with Brian Jones, a former elementary school teacher in Harlem and the current Green Party candidate for Lieutenant Governor of New York. Welcome, Brian, to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
It's nice to have you, Brian. You're a former elementary school teacher in Harlem, and you've been following the Vergara situation out in California. And I wanted to ask you to explain the ramifications of it, the background of it.
Well, essentially, the decision, the court ruled that teacher tenure in California was a violation of students' rights. It was a violation of their right to a quality education. The ramifications of it are that, or if we find students who are not doing well in school, that the remedy is to remove that teacher and get a new teacher. And therefore, anything that stands in the way of removing that teacher is therefore a violation of the student's rights. Even though that strikes a kind of intuitive, it makes a kind of intuitive sense to people, it actually is going to have very negative consequences, not just in California, but around the country. Because we already have a circumstance in which schools, and especially public schools in California, for example, are just coming out of a period of suffering from a decade of budget cuts. And that's not too different from the pattern around the country where we find public schools grossly underfunded, especially in urban neighborhoods, especially schools that are serving our highest need students. And so rather than pointing the proverbial finger at those conditions of funding and support and structure, this ruling says that that's not what's violating the students' rights, it's the teacher. And the reality is that the way to get the best teaching out of people and sustain that great work over long periods of time is not to sharpen the sword hanging over a teacher's head. In fact, we already have a problem holding on to great teachers. We have a problem holding on to teachers, period. As I cited in a piece I did for the New York Times Room for Debate blog, something like half of all public school teachers in the country leave the profession within 5 years. So we're literally bleeding teachers at a rate that's, I don't think, has a match in nearly any other profession where you would think, you know, you'd want to hold on to people and develop their expertise and experience over you know, a long career. Firefighting, law, medicine. I mean, you know, you don't want a crop of firefighters coming to your house who've only been on the job 1 or 2 years. You'd like to think there's some really experienced people who know what they're doing in the mix.
Brian, as you said, when I first read about this, it made a little bit of intuitive sense to me, but then I started to peel back the layers and realize that behind this movement is a Silicon Valley technology billionaire, David Welsh. Mm-hmm. Can you explain a bit about how he factors into this and that movement?
Well, I think he's a millionaire, technically. I don't know if he's a billionaire yet. But very wealthy people have taken a, and a lot of billionaires have taken a tremendous interest in totally transforming schools, public schools in this country. And mainly what they've been trying to do is to recreate the schools in their own image. That is, to take what innovations they bring to the marketplace, and following that logic, they think that those same innovations will and should revolutionize schooling. And a lot of that has to do with their idea that schooling should be run more like a business, that with more authority and power and decision-making concentrated at the top, and with the workers and students and parents having little or no say in what goes on. Their job is to just accomplish the tasks laid out before them by the millionaires and billionaires. One of the worst examples, of course, is Bill Gates, who's been effectively setting education policy for the nation for several years now. So that is a highly problematic situation. In this case, you have a millionaire in California who, like you say, a Silicon Valley millionaire, who created a quote-unquote parent group. And then bringing this lawsuit, you have a bunch of parents who are in charter schools and private schools, arguing that their rights are being violated. And I haven't seen any evidence that any of the plaintiff's students are actually sitting in front of teachers performing gross misconduct. But leave that aside. They use their wealth to effect the changes that they want. And the problem with that is that they therefore bypass any kind of democratic process or debate or discussion about what our schools should be like. And by virtue of the size of their bank accounts, they decide what will be in New Jersey, in New York City, in Los Angeles, and increasingly nationwide.
I want to go back to what you said in the beginning about that getting rid of the tenure, you know, has what was the word you used? Has some
it makes intuitive sense to people.
Yeah, it makes intuitive sense. But I want to explore that for a second because I don't know anything about this area, really.
Yeah.
But first of all, I know that before you get tenure, obviously there's a whole number of evaluations teachers have to go through before they get tenure. So you're not exactly getting bad teachers who get tenure. That's the first thing. The second thing is, if you were to abolish tenure, wouldn't that just eliminate a lot of people from going into teaching altogether if their job was in jeopardy every single year? So, yes, I understand that to some people it makes intuitive sense, but I was listening to it, and in some way it doesn't make any sense at all to me. So I'm just interested in your thoughts on that.
Yeah, no, I think that people, the public is being led to believe that the teachers out there doing gross misconduct, just absolutely horrible teachers who have no business standing in front of children, that's the problem. And anything that stands between us and firing those people is, you know, is problematic. Like, that's the campaign that's being whipped up. The problem is that even by the most generous estimates, the court had an estimate with no research. The judge was, his conscience was shocked by the idea that it might be 1% to 3% of California's teachers. And so effectively you have a witch hunt kind of atmosphere where we're going to ruin the working conditions for 97% in order to find that 1% to 3%. But what you say about tenure is also true. People are being led to believe that it's like tenure in higher education, a very robust protection where it's nearly impossible to dismiss a professor. In pre-K through 12 education, it is not a job for life. It's due process. And many Fortune 500 corporations have such rules in place where people understand that they cannot be just dismissed at will. There has to be a process. There has to be evidence. There have to be hearings. They are presumed innocent until proven guilty. And really, everybody should have that at their job, I think,
right?
People who work a job.
Brian, I want to ask you a follow the money question, because it strikes me as that the charter school movement and now this attack on teachers is all part of a same piece, and that's to privatize education and make education into an opportunity for entrepreneurs to make money.
Absolutely.
For example, if you have a charter school, you can have a teacher with a script, and you can sell the charter school prepackaged software and prepackaged hardware. you can turn education into a commodity, where a teacher is just really a figure there, and doesn't have to be paid very much.
Yeah. Well, and, you also benefit. I mean, if you're trying to cut costs, you benefit from a model that's more like Teach for America, where people, you know, kind of come and do teaching for a few years on their way to something else, on their way to law school or whatever. And that model is cheaper because you never have anybody retiring. You never have people maxing out the pay scale. You never have to deal with pensions. You always have people at the lowest level of pay because they're, you know, just in it for a few years and then moving on. So that model certainly is becoming more and more the model in schooling.
Brown versus the Board of Education was, you know, the famous 1954 case against segregated schools, saying there's no such thing as separate but equal. And the judge in the Vigar decision cited, ironically, Brown versus the Board of Education.
This is a famous ploy of the kind of corporate privatizers, is to wrap themselves in the robes of the civil rights movement and claim that they're getting justice on behalf of children. But we ought to remember that the actual civil rights movement was very pro-union, was very involved in unions. Martin Luther King first gave his I Have a Dream speech at a UAW event, United Auto Workers event. The march, the 1963 March on Washington, was a march for jobs and freedom, and one of its main architects was a union organizer, A. Philip Randolph. I mean, we have to bring back that history and remember that the whole idea that people were pushing towards of more of a human rights frame, it was the idea that our various rights are indivisible. The corporate reformers want us to believe we can get justice for kids by beating up on adults. If we can attack the union, we can then get justice for the young people. And I think we're never going to really improve our schools that way, by beating up on the people who work in the schools. It's a very management-oriented vision of justice. Justice for the client means making things hot for the worker. You know, in the, or for the customer, and where they want you to, you know, think of the young people and students and their families as the customers. I think that we're going to see a real reform of education when we see students and teachers and their families actually more empowered in the education process. But giving real power to parents and parent organizations, giving real power to teachers and teacher organizations, and giving real power to students and student organizations violates the logic of privatization, which is that you have to have a CEO, quote unquote, of the school who decides. You know, that's what the tenure attack is about, eliminating an obstacle for anybody else to speak back, to talk back. I've spoken with countless educators in southern states where they have no tenure, no unions, right-to-work states, and they tell me that they don't even go to protests. They don't go to protests even about issues that are not related to education because they're afraid to be seen at a protest and that they will lose their job. And so without tenure, without unions, and by the way, tenure and unions are not synonymous. Actually, we had tenure before we had unions in education. But without those kinds of protections, the people working in a school can never speak back, can never express themselves, can never protest or try to assert some other idea, or even just assert themselves, if they have no protections like that. And so I think the way we're going, if we're going in a direction that's anti-tenure and anti-union, we're going to see a concentration of power at the top in education and very little power for learners, for teachers, for families, that sort of thing.
So do you predict that this Vigara lawsuit's going to be replicated in other states around the country?
It looks like they're going to try to replicate it. I don't know if they'll be successful. I mean, the thing was so thinly conceived that I don't know if that will work. In the meantime, I think, you know, there's a lot that those of us who want to defend and improve public education need to do to reframe it. Let's talk about what it's going to take to improve the teaching profession. Let's talk about what it's going to take to improve the conditions of teaching and learning. Let's talk about what it's going to take to retain great teachers and to develop and sustain great teaching in our schools. And certainly I think we need to make an argument that we don't get any of those things by sharpening a sword that's hanging over the head of teachers. That doesn't help us create the kind of conditions that we want in schools for great teaching and learning.
You're friends, I know, with teachers. You taught in Harlem for many years. What was the reaction to people you know to this decision?
Oh, they just thought it was outrageous. I mean, it's just teachers feel under attack. It's like one year they're publishing your name in the newspaper next to your students' test scores. The next year they're asking you, you know, they want you to document everything you do. So you spend half your time teaching, the other half trying to document the fact that you are teaching for some kind of accountability regime to prove that you're actually teaching. But the problem is all the effort and documentation required to prove that you're actually teaching takes you away from actually teaching. I mean, the things that we are putting on teachers' shoulders right now are insane. And I think that's why people are just livid about this. People just have had it and feel like it's not fair to put all of the blame on teachers for the conditions in our schools. How dare these people close the schools, shuffle the kids around, cut the budgets, overwhelm them with standardized tests, take away physical education, and then if Johnny's not succeeding at the highest levels, blame the teacher. It's outrageous. And so I think people are just livid, feel like it's really not fair. Teachers are being scapegoated.
Yeah, no, it sounds like really shocking what you're saying. I have a question, the reaction to the decision and, you know, a lot, of course, over the last few years about charter schools, privatizing schools. And I guess he's the education person in the Obama administration is Arne Duncan.
Yeah.
And he reacted, I think, as I recall, very favorably to this decision. So I'd like to hear something about Arne Duncan, why Obama has him in there, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, look, teachers overwhelmingly voted for Obama. It's hard to find a teacher who didn't vote for Obama. People had really high hopes because on the campaign trail, he said all the right things about No Child Left Behind. And then he got into office, and instead of appointing, you know, a serious education professional like Linda Darling Hammond to be his Secretary of Education, he appoints Arne Duncan, whose claim to fame was neoliberalizing education, privatizing education in Chicago. So that was a signal right there from the beginning that this wasn't going to be good. And then we got Race to the Top, which was his plan to dangle, you know, small amounts of money to cash-starved municipalities to try to encourage them to remove the cap on charter schools, tie teacher pay and retention and promotion to test scores. So we were already suffering under a high-stakes testing regime because of George W. Bush's No Child Left Behind legislation. Then Obama doubled down on it and made it even worse. He raised the stakes of those high-stakes tests even higher. So there's been a pattern of remarkable consistency, you could argue, from the Bush years into the Obama years in these terms, in terms of what's been happening to education. And Arne Duncan has been a cheerleader of it every step of the way. He said that Hurricane Katrina was the best thing that could have happened to the school system in New Orleans because not only did it wash away the town, but it washed away the schools and it washed away the teachers' union. And so they got rid of the teachers' union and they got rid of the public schools, and now they have a 100% charterized, market-oriented schools where parents are liberated from their local public school and now become shoppers on the free market of schools. And the people who run the schools say that they are not public school managers in the traditional sense. They are just portfolio managers, managing a portfolio of schools, and teacher and parents receive a booklet of 94 schools to shop from. Yeah. They want to recreate. We see in places like New Orleans, which Arne Duncan has hailed, a kind of future vision that they want for schools, where instead of a school having an obligation to students who live near it, where parents can come in, expect to be served for free, and also parents come in empowered with all kinds of rights. They can make demands of the school. The school has an obligation to meet the needs of the student, whatever those needs are, however expensive those needs are. The parent can make those demands of the school. Instead, in the charterized portfolio model, no particular school has an obligation to serve any particular student. And so they call it a choice, and that's very, again, once again, they're appealing to a kind of intuitive sense, like, oh, if I have choices, I'm empowered. But the problem is the schools also do the choosing. And no school has any obligation to serve any particular child.
Brian Jones, I was just in Chicago last month promoting a book I co-edited called Imagine Living in a Socialist USA, which has a very fine chapter, I should add, by Bill Ayers on education. But in any case, I was shocked to find out when I was in Chicago that this neoliberal model that Arne Duncan, who's from Chicago, is trying to bring to the United States, they've already done in several other spheres mm-hmm. in Chicago. They've privatized the parking meters. They've yeah. privatized the Chicago Skyway. Mm. And they're looking to privatize even more schools there. But I wanted to shift the subject a little bit because we're coming down to the end of our time and ask you this. I know you're running with Howie Hawkins is running for governor in New York, and you're running as lieutenant governor. And I wanted to ask you what kind of notions you're going to put out to the public with respect to education in your campaign as a socialist candidate for lieutenant governor.
Great question. Thanks for asking. Our whole platform is available. Anybody can read it at howiehawkins.org. But essentially what we're saying is that we need to conceive of education as a human right, that young people ought to have the right to a fully funded, excellent education. You know, we had free higher education here in New York City for something like 125 years. And with I'm talking about the city university system, and with a small tax on the rich, especially in a city like New York and in a state like New York State, we could return to a situation where students could go all the way up through the PhD for free. And I think that's the kind of model we need to return to, and we need to argue for that and fight for that. This is ridiculous. I'm walking around with my, you know, green party button that says we need a $15 an hour minimum wage. And everywhere I go, young people are coming up to me saying I'm 27 and I have $27,000 in college loan debt. And I'm working at this crappy job because I can't afford to leave it and try to do things that I'm really interested in because I have to pay $500 every month just to service this debt. So we're telling kids, like, stay in school, go all the way through, go to college. And the problem is that the students who are able to actually make it through the system and do that end up as kind of debt slaves. So this is a ridiculous situation. It absolutely has to stop. And what the Democratic Party is offering people is this kind of stingy market mechanism. Once again, we're not going to alleviate your student loan debt. We're going to give you better information about your student loans so you can be a more well-informed shopper of student loans. We need to abolish student loans and return to a situation where people have free education all the way up through the PhD. And just one more thing I want to say is that a new report shows that New York State has the most segregated schools in the nation. So that I haven't seen anywhere the governor make Andrew Cuomo make any comment about this. This absolutely is a scandal and it has to be rectified. And one of the main things I think we need to do is return to the question of equity in school funding and look at the gross disparities between who's getting what kind of funding.
Ryan Jones, it's been a pleasure to have you on Law and Disorder. We thank you. We're going to follow your campaign. We hope you'll come back on as a guest. You take it easy, and good luck to you.
Yeah, thanks again.
I love hearing your passion on the issue. I mean, people have to listen to it because the narrative in this country on some levels in the major media is mm-hmm. so terrible. And I remember seeing Waiting for Superman. That was that movie about charter schools that got lauded by nominated for Academy Award, and how outraged I was by it. You guys just tore unions apart.
Yeah. Well, that's why some of the activists in New York City got together and made a film called The Inconvenient Truth Behind Waiting for Superman, which is available for free online. If people Google it, it'll come right up.
That's great. Well, thanks, thank you. Brian. Your work is really inspiring. It's really good to hear.
Thanks for having me on.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.